This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Drew Carey, star of the sitcom The Drew Carey Show and author of the new bestseller, Dirty Jokes and Beer. Drew Carey, I like the way your book shifts tone successfully, I think, between telling, you know, dirty jokes and so on, and talking, you know, pretty candidly about more depressing things like your suicide attempts.
Yeah.
You know, I really think that so many comics are depressives.
Yeah, maybe they are, yeah. I mean, I don't know why that is, but yeah, I'm probably right. I wouldn't be, yeah. I'd have to say you're right when you say that.
What sent you over the edge with the suicide attempts?
This was years ago,
like when you were in college?
I was 18, and then the other time I was like 21. And you just, a lot of it to me had to do with, like, I didn't have any goals in life. I didn't have any direction. And, you know, when you're like that, you know, you have nothing to work for, nothing to live for. You figure, why live anymore? And you just feel like you're the biggest creep in the, you know, you're a loser. You're not going anywhere. You know, nothing's happening for you. You know, if nobody miss you, if you did kill yourself, you're just taking up space. You know, you're just, why are you living your life? You're just going day to day for nothing. You know, you have to go to this crummy job. You have to, you know, what are you working for? What are you living for? Nothing. You know, you have nothing going on, no plans. So when you're like that, you know, that it's killing yourself's like a good option. You know,
what did you choose to end it with?
Oh, it's sissy sleeping pills. That probably wouldn't have worked anyway if I didn't. Like the first time I took a bunch of, like a whole bottle of Somanex, and I, who knows if that would have killed me, but might have put me to sleep for a weekend. But I, as soon as I swallowed them, you know, I told my friends, my fraternity brothers, I said, I just tried to kill myself. You got to get me to that. I swallowed a big couple glasses of beer, and they took me to the health center, and they gave me Epicac, you know, and it was over. I stayed in the health center like overnight and stuff, and they called my parents, but, you know, and then the second time was a lot more serious. I took another bottle of sleeping pills and alcohol, and I called this one girl I was dating to say goodbye, and she figured out what I was doing and called somebody. But I just remember waking up in the hospital. So they just, you know, they came to God. It was a lot more serious attempt the second time. The first time, as soon as I took the pills, I thought, what the hell am I doing? What if I die? You know, or I mean, that was the idea, to die. And then I thought, wow, if I die, what's going to happen to me? You know, and that scared me so much. You know, the thought of going to hell or any of that, kind of like so unsure about that kind of thing, that I got somebody to help me right away.
Have you ever done suicide jokes?
Yeah. I joke around about everything. I joked around about my dad dying before I was a comedian, even when I was just in college and high school. I used to make jokes about my dad being dead. You know, people always thought I was really sick. But, I mean, that's how a lot of people deal with bad things and bad news, is they make jokes about it.
Yeah.
And that's how they can cope with, because there's so much bad news in the world all the time. You know, especially nowadays when you have all this information coming at you. You know, I don't think we were built to have so much negative information coming at us and bombarding us through the day with the newspaper and the TV and the radio. And bad news always leads off every half hour. You know, you never see, you never see the Good News Network. That would be off the air. It wouldn't exist. Nobody would watch it. But like, you know, so you come up with these coping mechanisms, and one of the ways to cope is to laugh about it. That's why you make Versace jokes and space shuttle jokes after the space shuttle blew up. I remember friends of mine calling me within 5 minutes of the space shuttle blowing up with jokes about it blowing up.
Huh.
And, you know, if I knew, it's just a sad, big disaster, and that's the way people cope with these kind of things.
Drew Carey is my guest, star, of course, of The Drew Carey Show, and author of the new bestseller, Dirty Jokes and Beer, Stories of the Unrefined. You enlisted in the Marine Reserve Corps.
Right.
How old were you when you did it? What was your motivation?
I was like 23, I must have been. It was in 80. I needed money. I needed a job. I was it was always in the back, you know, I must have been from playing with Army men when I was a kid or something, but it's always, you know, being in the military was always in the back of my mind as a last resort. If nothing else ever worked out, you could always join the Army. You know, that's always how I thought. And I was living in Las Vegas and having a really bad time, and I got thrown out of my motel room that I was living in because I couldn't pay the rent. And I had my car that was totaled in the first place, had everything stolen out of it. So all it was left with was like the clothes on my back and a few other things that they didn't take. And so my buddy gave me a ride to L.A. to stay with my brother who lived in Mission Viejo. My brother took me in and got me a job, bought me some clothes, and he worked for a Porsche Audi dealer, and I would deliver parts in Southern California in this van. That was my job, and he was the parts manager. And when the owner of the place found out that he didn't want relatives working for relatives because it'd be easy to steal from the place then. And so my brother had to fire me from that job.
Oh, no.
So I was in Mission Viejo. My brother had to fire me, and I didn't want to mooch off him, you know. And I didn't only all I had was a little bit of clothes that he bought me. He had to buy me underwear and everything. I didn't have anything when I showed up at his door because everything was stolen out of my car after I got kicked out of my motel room. And so I thought, I'll just join the service. And I went to the recruiting office, and I went to the Navy thing, and I talked to those guys. And while I was in the before I could go in, I was in the lobby, and the Marine guy came out and saw me. And he looked really squared away and everything. He said, "Look, make sure you see me before you leave." So I just saw the Navy guys. I went over to visit with the Marine guy. And he was, you know, he was just a good salesman, man. He talked me into joining the Marines. And I thought, if I'm going to join the service, I just want to join the toughest one, you know, and get it over with. I don't want to take the easy way out from this. I'm just doing this one time, you know, because you just can't switch branches of service throughout your life and go through boot camp after boot camp. So I joined the Marines, and it was great.
What was great about it?
I really liked it. Well, first of all, I got 3 meals a day. I was earning my own money. I was so happy after that, you know, mooch off my brother and getting kicked out of my motel in Vegas. I was so happy just to have a job. They really are good at building like a team spirit and a camaraderie, you know, and every day you get done, you really feel like you've been doing something, you know, and accomplishing something. And I was running and getting in shape and, you know. And I was older than a lot of the guys in the platoon, you know, so I knew what they were doing, like psychologically when they were doing stuff to me. So, I mean, they could yell, I just stood there, didn't bother me, you know, I knew they weren't out to hurt me. So everything they said to do, I would just do it as fast as I could right away. And I trusted them, you know, and a lot of people think you go to boot camp and they go, oh, the drill instructor's out to really, he's going to try to hurt you. That's his job. But it's not his job. The drill instructor's job is to make you into a Marine and to get you through this training. And all you have to do is, I'm telling you, I did. I just totally trusted him. I thought, this guy's really not going to hurt me. You know, I just got to do what he says. And so that's all I did. And it came out, it worked out really well. I graduated from boot camp with a meritorious PFC. I got a top 10% of my, they give the guys in the top 10% of the platoon a meritorious promotion. So I got meritorious PFC out of boot camp and really did good. I really liked the reserves. I had a lot of friends. I liked the life, you know.
This is great. Really, the Marines kind of gave you a sense of accomplishment, a sense of self-esteem, and a look.
Yeah. Yeah. I know. The Marines were pretty good to me. I'm telling you, man, I'd still be in the Marine Reserves if I wasn't doing stand-up. I quit because I was making, you know, I saw the money you could make doing weekends, and I was only making like $125 a weekend in the reserves as a sergeant, you know, and I thought, you know, then I could make $300 on a weekend if I was a stand-up comic starting out. So why would I give up that $300, you know, for the whole 120? So I quit during the Marines.
Huh. So before we have to let you go, are you beloved in Parma?
People in Cleveland, Parma, they, you know, I don't want to brag on myself or anything, but I'm very, very popular. Yeah, it's insane when I go back home, how people treat me. Like, thank you for everything you've done for Cleveland. Gee, we love your show. Everywhere I go, it's the greatest. I mean, my fans in Cleveland are the greatest. I'm telling you, I try to give them as much love back as they give me. It really makes it all worthwhile. Because I'm telling you, man, when you grow up in Cleveland, you have Cleveland made fun of all the time. When you're growing up, your Cleveland jokes on TV and stuff like that. And when you go out to, like, go to college, you're from Cleveland, ha, 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 and people make fun of you just because of the town you're from. That's why I couldn't wait to get when I got my show, I couldn't wait to have it set in Cleveland and promote Cleveland. And I just want to shove Cleveland down everybody's throats now to get back at them, you know, to get back at them for making a, I just want to cram it down everybody's throat and make them chew it. And so, yeah, it's great. And people in Cleveland know exactly what I'm talking about. And so they're really grateful, and I'm grateful to them.
Well, Drew Carey, it's really been fun having you on the show. Thank you so much for talking with us.
Oh, thank you.
Drew Carey is the star of the sitcom The Drew Carey Show. His new book is called Dirty Jokes and Beer. The new book, The Soul of the Game, is about the legendary players of street basketball and the best-known playgrounds in the country. Pee Wee Kirkland is one of the players profiled. He also wrote the introduction. He learned the game in the 60s at one of New York's famous playgrounds, Rucker Park in Harlem. He went on to play for Norfolk State. In 1968, a Sports Illustrated article said he may be the fastest man in college basketball. Kirkland was drafted by the Chicago Bulls, quickly cut, and then returned to Rucker Park. But after getting into trouble related to drug dealing, he ended up playing on a prison team in Pennsylvania while serving a 10-year sentence. Now he coaches the team at a private school in Manhattan, the Dwight School. They won their first high school championship this year. Kirkland was the technical advisor on the basketball movie Above the Rim. I asked him if there are certain moves that came from street basketball.
I don't know if there are any moves that didn't come from street basketball. Shake and bake, head fake, stutter step freeze, 360, crossover, reverse crossover. I mean, all these moves came from street basketball. I mean, when you watch Michael Jordan in the NBA, when he made that great move in the playoff and he had it in one hand in the air and he switched it in the air from his right to his left hand and he kissed it off the glass with a little spin. I mean, it was a great move because they showed it over and over on national television so the world could see it. But that was a move that I would do when I was 13 years old. And that was a move that it's just a natural, regular move in street basketball. But it had to be introduced to the NBA. And it was in an unbelievable way at an unbelievable time. And you have to credit Michael Jordan for that.
What about trash talking? Do you think that comes from street ball, too?
It's amazing that you'd ask me that question because a lot of people said I was the guy who invented trash talking in basketball. I know I did at Rucker, you know. I mean, it wasn't enough for me to come to the game to score 40, 50, or 60 points. It was more important to me to announce it because if I announced it, then it would make me real as a competitor. Sort of like what Muhammad Ali used to do when he would announce fights. People would say, when you're going to win? He'd name the round. He'd name if it would be a knockout, if it would be a decision. That sort of take the hyper street basketball to another level.
So what would you say on the court?
Well, I would say things like push up. You can't guard me. You know, wait a minute, hold up, push up. You ain't got no defense. You don't know what defense is. Watch, lay. I ain't going to shoot the J. I'm going to shoot the lay. I'm going to keep taking you to the basket till you want to walk off the court. I'm going to make you ask your coach to take you out. Things like that.
Trash talking is pretty controversial, I think, in professional basketball. What do you think of it there?
Well, it's controversial in professional basketball because in professional basketball it's sort of out of control simply because they don't want to accept it. I think when professional, the NBA, decides to stamp certain players as being great players, they don't want the crowd to see that person be abused verbally on the court. And, you know, trash talking can get into verbal abuse, irregardless if it's done intentionally or not intentionally. I don't think anybody wants to see somebody on the court talking trash to a Michael Jordan. Say, for instance, a guy like myself, I could never play against Jordan without talking trash talk because I would want to try to get into Jordan's head. That's another level of the game to see how good a person is mentally. And that's what a street basketball player would want to reach, that person mentally, because you may not be able to break a guy down physically, so you try to break him down mentally.
What did you have to do when you were a kid to prove yourself on the court so that, you know, you could play with other people so that you wouldn't just be playing by yourself?
When I was a kid? Oh, you mean just to get on the court on regular?
Yeah.
Well, what you had to do was you had to prove that you had heart, number one. Number two, you had to prove that you had skills. You had to have a reason for getting on the court because the courts were so crowded in them days that you'd be standing on the side for 7 and 8 hours trying to figure out how to get on the court unless somebody knew you was a good ball player, you was a good scorer, you was a good defensive player, you could block shots. You could, you know, it was winners. They called it winners then, and the winners stayed on the court. So my purpose in coming early was to be on the court and stay on the court till the end of the day. And sometime we played from 8, 9 o'clock in the morning to 12, 1 o'clock at night.
What's the longest you had to wait to get on the court?
Well, I never had to wait. And the reason I never had to wait because I started basketball maybe at the age of 11 or 12 and under the tutelage of a coach named Roger Bryant, who's more like a father figure. And he taught me so much about the game and how to think the game and understand the game from the neck up that my reputation sort of grew real fast. So when I walked in the park, I mean, I actually have walked in the park and had guys say, we picked him to play until you came. Now, he can go sit down and you got your, you come on, let's do this. You know, things like that.
When you'd have one of those tournaments with players from the NBA, where would crowds gather to watch you from? I mean, were there bleachers or anything? Was there a place to be?
When I played in Rucker, Rucker is a small area.
Mm-hmm.
It was at least 3,000 people packed in Rucker watching the game. You had people on fences who had climbed on fences. You had people, it was above Rucker was sort of like a bridge, an overpass. You had mm-hmm. people standing on the overpass. I used to look up sometime when I was on the foul line and see people looking out of project windows with binoculars. Outside of Rucker, you couldn't see a car no place. It was really hard to get in Rucker because Rucker was on 155th Street and 8th Avenue, and at least for 15 blocks going downtown on 8th Avenue, it was packed, sort of like Coney Island or something, like it was a museum. It was because people actually waited outside at Rucker until the game was over, and then when the game they wanted to see, they would come inside. And when we played against teams like Julius Erving and Tiny Archibald, big games, when me and Joe Hamble was in the backcourt together, that the streets considered big games, at that time, 3 or 4 hours before the game, people were sitting there waiting.
You were drafted out of college by the Chicago Bulls, but you never really played with them. Why not?
My problem with Chicago is I got drafted with a guy who went to a much larger school. I don't want to say his name, but when we arrived at Chicago together and we finally played against each other, I mean, it was no contest the way I played compared to the way he played. You had a guy that actually couldn't go but one way. And in street basketball, that's like not being able to talk and chew bubblegum at the same time. So I was much more advanced in the game, but the coach had explained to me because he went to a junior college, a bigger school, and I went to a smaller school, that he would start, and I left that night.
So you walked out?
That night I left. I just never came back to the gym.
Wasn't that cutting your nose to spite your face?
Well, when you're a kid, you don't always know that you are cutting your nose off to spite your face when you make those type of decisions. Now, I would tell kids today that that was one of the biggest mistakes I ever made in my life, because I understand the importance of kids drawing from that type of experience. That's another thing the book reveals, that a lot of players who have made decisions that they should not have made, you know, I mean, it's understood in the book that they wish they had that decision to make again. And me leaving Chicago was not a good decision.
You're now working with young people in Harlem at a place you started called School for Skills, and you're working with young people at a very exclusive private school in Manhattan called the Dwight School. Do you find that you have to give different types of advice to kids who are coming from poverty than you do to kids who are coming from, you know, fairly upper middle class or wealthy backgrounds?
Oh, it's no question. You know, most of the kids that are in poverty, they are closer to being targeted. Because kids in private schools, basically, they live in areas where crime do not exist. But kids in poverty, they walk around crime. When they come home, it's crime. When they leave to go to school, they see crime. They come in a building, it's crime. I mean, they see it. There's no way they can get around it. So naturally, you talk to them about crime and about people approaching them and try to make them understand how to avoid crime, try to make them understand the end result. I try to make them look at my life like they're looking in a mirror and look at how my life was destroyed because I allowed myself to make the wrong decision at an early age. And when you're dealing with kids in private schools, it's almost like you sort of talk to them in a way like, well, you don't want to find yourself associating with the wrong kind of person because that can lead to crime. Or when you think in terms of rap music, you might not want to spend as much time listening to videos because you might find yourself in a situation where your grades may go from 90 to 80 as opposed to a kid in the ghetto would find his grades going from 70 to him not being in school.
Do a lot of the young people who you work with at the private school and at your School for Skills expect to be in the NBA, expect that they're really going to make it in the NBA?
Well, not really. Not a lot of them, but there are a few of them.
Do you encourage them or discourage them from thinking that way?
Well, I just be real with them, and I tell them, you know, the percentages of a person making the NBA is very small, mm-hmm. that, you know, is more important that you figure out a way to establish yourself in life and to be able to make sure that you have a future. You know, if you plan to become an NBA player and you don't have an education or you don't have nothing else planned in the future and don't become an NBA player, you may find yourself homeless. So I just keep it real and explain that type of thing to the kids. But I also explain to every kid who I think has that type of potential and has that type of dream, what he needs to do, what he needs to learn, what he needs to think to become an NBA player.
Pee Wee Kirkland, he wrote the introduction to the new book, The Soul of the Game, Images and Voices of Street Basketball.